The evening prayer is just about to start at Al-Azhar Mosque at the heart of medieval Cairo. This mosque was built in the 10th century and it has evolved into the most prestigious seat of learning in Sunni Islam. It has, over the years, become a global hub. It trains thousands of Muslim clerics from all over the world every year. So its influence reaches far beyond the borders of Egypt. I'm now walking towards the pulpit. It's a much smaller structure, actually, than I thought it would be. And it is from that spot that Muslim leaders have throughout the centuries rallied the faithful and urged them to come to the defense of Islam. Today it is Al-Azhar itself which is under attack. It has come in for some very vocal and vociferous criticism. Critics say Al-Azhar, far from being a bastion of moderation as it claims to be, its unreformed and antiquated curriculum is precisely the kind of literature used by militants such as Daesh, a so-called Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, to wage war against the unbelievers or the infidels, or even other fellow Muslims. I'm Magdi Abdelhadi and I'm here for the BBC World Service Heart and Soul to explore what lies behind the debate in Egypt about Al-Azhar and its standing and its future, and whether it can have any lasting impact on the standing of this hallowed and ancient institution.
Al-Azhar should apologize for the Arab conquests if it really wanted to distance itself from killing in the name of Islam.
Al-Azhar is the problem, not the solution.
The criticism of Al-Azhar grew ever more shrill after an extraordinary intervention from President Sisi himself back in January
2015. It's impossible that this kind of thinking drive the entire Muslim world to become a source of anxiety, danger, killing and destruction. To the extent that we antagonize the whole world. It's inconceivable that 1.5 billion Muslims will kill the whole 7 billion in the world so that they alone can live.
Al-Azhar has seen off a few storms before in its long history. But the immediate trigger to this one was not in Egypt, though.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. Islamic State appears to have killed the Jordanian pilot it captured at the end of last year. In this case, Lieutenant Mu'ath al-Kasasbey is shown walking at gunpoint through rubble. He's then penned inside a metal cage which has been doused in oil. A fuse is lit and he's engulfed in flames.
It was this level of violence and barbarity in the name of Islam that shocked not just non-Muslims, but many in the Muslim world and fueled the controversy about who is to blame.
Hatred and bloodshed are backed up by curricula that are taught in the Islamic world over and are approved by Islamic scholars, the ones who wear turbans.
Those who wear turbans is how Ahmad Abdu Maher, a lawyer and vociferous critic of Al-Azhar, describes the Azhari scholars. Ahmad Abdu Maher is also a former military intelligence officer who came face to face with the ideology of militant Islam when he was still a serving young officer.
When I interrogated the extremists and talked with Azhari scholars, I reached the conclusion that extremism comes primarily from the ancient books of Islamic jurisprudence, which we've turned into sacred texts. These texts could have been forgotten long ago had it not been for those wearing the turbans. They are the main reason for the disaster that has befallen Islam. Islam has been turned from a faith into prison because, according to their jurisprudence, if you leave Islam, you should get killed.
At the heart of the criticism of the Azhari curriculum is what is known as hadith, the recorded oral tradition of the Prophet, his words and deeds, also known as sunnah, which is, according to the Islamic doctrine, quite distinct from the revelation, the Quran itself. The hadiths were collected from various narrators a couple of centuries after the death of the Prophet. Together with the Quran, they form the main source of what has become known as Sharia, or Islamic law. So, for example, the controversial practice of female genital mutilation is based on just one reported hadith, even though many scholars dispute its authenticity. Another hadith alleges that the Prophet had been ordered by Allah to fight everyone till they embrace Islam, a hadith which is often quoted by militants to justify the holy war against everyone else, be they in Syria or in France.
The disaster is that they turn these sayings into a science and consider those who don't believe in them kafir or unbeliever. And that is the disaster. I had hoped that Al-Azhar would apologize for the Muslim conquests if it really wanted to denounce the use of violence to spread the faith, or capturing women, turning them into sex slaves for the Muslim warriors. All the things that were practiced by early Muslims thinking that was Islam, but it wasn't. God never ordained the Prophet to use force to convert people to Islam, or even use the sword to do so.
We will hear from Al-Azhar shortly, but let's first meet the man whose name became associated with this type of criticism more than anyone else, and paid a heavy price for it. His name is Islam Al-Bihiri, a researcher on Islamic tradition who decided to take to the airwaves to fight for his own understanding of the Islamic scriptures. As a result, he was jailed for 1 year on a controversial charge known as contempt of religion. His TV show, which has also been suspended by a court order, dealt with the first anthologies of hadith, especially the one compiled by a man from what is today Central Asia and was written around the 9th century.
When I was a young man, I started reading that huge book by Al-Bukhari. As a teenager, you see what your mother does at home and at work. And she has a special place, especially for adolescent boys. But then you find out that women described in that book as mentally and morally inferior to men, and that way of viewing women is attributed to the Prophet. Why? Because women have that monthly affliction. But that is not logical. How can God create you in a certain way, then holds you to account for it?
And Islam Al-Bihiri is not alone in being confounded by some parts of this oral tradition, especially when it seems to run counter to logic or common sense. Take, for example, this one. Under Islamic Sharia, a man and a woman cannot be left alone unless they are close relatives. According to one controversial hadith, to circumvent that ban, the woman could breastfeed the man, thus gaining the symbolic status of his mother. When that hadith was brought to the attention of the public a few years ago, it caused an uproar of laughter and resentment. It was fighting this kind of oral tradition that cost Islam Al-Bihiri 1 year of his life. But has this dented his enthusiasm? A few weeks later, Islam Al-Bihiri was indeed on the airwaves again in a program that plays on his first name and what he believes he stands for, Islam Hur, or Free Islam. Islam Al-Bihiri was pardoned by the president, albeit near the end of his 1 year prison term. Could this be a tacit endorsement of Bihiri's campaign by Sisi himself? If so, this could also imply that Al-Azhar and the president are not on the same page.
Absolutely. It's very obvious. And I think the president himself said it once. For 3 years, the head of the state asks one of its institutions, which according to the constitution is under his command, to do that, but they don't do it.
There are indeed frequent signs that the president and the leadership of Al-Azhar don't see eye to eye on the question of reform inside Al-Azhar. Al-Bihiri believes there is a reason for that.
Because Al-Azhar cannot do it. Al-Azhar is the problem and not the solution. Al-Azhar cannot reform itself, because if it does reform itself, it would lose all authority. Al-Azhar is fighting for its own survival and not for the religion itself. Al-Azhar wants people to continue to need it. Ask, ask, and ask. My entire spiritual life is in their hands. But if the Muslim individual begins to think, to use his mind, religion is not a science. Each Muslim has the right to discuss religion. But they want you to follow religion as they understand it. What terrified Al-Azhar was mass media. As an intellectual, you can write books, but they don't reach everyone. Now, we are using their weapon. We are entering every home by using television.
Al-Bahiri's young age and charisma may very well have stung the old institution.
Although Al-Azhar has expanded and evolved into a modern university that teaches science, inside the ancient mosque itself, time seems to have stood still. There are a few religious classes going on in the traditional fashion, a cleric on a low chair, surrounded by students squatting on the floor. They come from Egypt or from Asia or Africa. Outside in the courtyard, the building is covered in tarpaulin and scaffolding, so a change of some kind has already taken place. The question is it just a facelift or a sign of more profound change to come in the future?
I went to see number two in Al-Azhar, Sheikh Abbas Shuman, a dark man with an imposing figure in traditional clerical robes and a white turban wrapped around a red cap. Before we switch on our recording equipment, he lays one condition. No questions about Islam al-Bahiri, the young Azhar critic we heard from earlier. I ask him about the response of Al-Azhar to President Sisi's call for a revolution in Islamic thinking.
Al-Azhar has indeed finished reviewing Azhari curriculum and is working together with the Ministry of Education to review the religious textbooks for schools. The outstanding problem, which is the bigger problem, is that there is no restraint in mass media. There are many who are not experts who appear on the media and social media, and those who are considered religious scholars who speak about religion, and they are not qualified to do so.
I understood this to be a reference to critics of Al-Azhar in the media, many of whom are, of course, not Azhari scholars, but journalists and intellectuals. I put it to Sheikh Shuman that his critics say that the changes Al-Azhar made to its textbooks were purely cosmetic.
There are those who do not want Al-Azhar to play an active role. That is why, whenever they find an opportunity, they unjustly accuse Al-Azhar or blame it for societal problems. Many of those who call themselves intellectuals view Sharia regulation as restraints on freedom of expression and creativity. They want Al-Azhar to release the artistic creation from these constraints, which is inconceivable for Al-Azhar to accept.
I went with the same questions to another equally influential part of the religious establishment, the offices of the Grand Mufti of Egypt, which is just a stone throw away from Al-Azhar. It is a modern building with marble floors on the edge of medieval Cairo, with heavily armed guards outside.
My name is Ibrahim Najm. I serve as the senior advisor to the Grand Mufti of Egypt, Dr. Shawqi Allam. I am a scholar. I spent 18 years of intensive study at Al-Azhar.
There, I got a more gentle reception from the Grand Mufti spokesman when I asked him about the calls for modernization of Al-Azhar textbooks.
What we do here at Dar al-Ifta, which is the premier Islamic legal interpretation arm of Al-Azhar, we have done a number of corrective as well as preventive measures to respond to this urgent call of reforming Islamic religious discourse. We have revisited a number of fatwas that were authored in the past, fatwas that unfortunately have given rise to a number of wrong behaviors. And I'm referring particularly to the fatwa regarding female genital mutilation that was condoned in the past based on a number of religious opinions. We have also worked very hard in the electronic space in response to the rise of radicalization. So our Facebook fan page is one of the most active pages in the religious establishment. We have about 5 million subscribers and followers in the Facebook fan page. We have also put together another Facebook fan page called Daesh Under the Microscope.
Daesh, that is a so-called Islamic State.
Yes. We have refuted their allegations. We have responded to their wrong interpretations of Islam, and this Facebook fan page is multilingual.
When I asked Dr. Negm about the textbooks taught by Al-Azhar, I was surprised to find him trying to distance himself.
I am representing Dar al-Ifta, but what I can share with you is that the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, His Eminence Dr. Ahmad Al-Tayyib, has formed a number of committees to revisit and look into these type of textbooks, and to my knowledge that they have already rectified a number of textbooks.
Take, for example, this book, which I have here, taught at Azhari Secondary Schools. Here, jihad is defined only as an armed struggle, but nothing is said of the other meaning of jihad, known, as you know, jihad an-nafs, which means restraint and self-improvement. The book also has that controversial hadith, according to which the Prophet had been commanded by God to fight the whole world until everybody converts to Islam. That is precisely the hadith used by Daesh, so-called Islamic State, to justify its brutal campaign.
We have to understand that this book was authored many, many centuries ago.
But that is the latest edition taught by Al-Azhar, 2016.
No, the book itself. The book itself... is about fiqh in English means Islamic law, which covers the legal matters of the individuals and the state. Therefore, when the topic of jihad is discussed, it is discussed in the sense of armed struggle, which is basically warfare. What are the rules and regulations regarding launching legitimate warfare? This kind of textbooks, as I have mentioned previously, were authored many centuries ago, where the international order back then is radically different from the order we live in right now. The other meanings of jihad, which of course is not mentioned in this particular text, are also mentioned in other important subjects that we have studied, including morals, including ethics, where jihad is extensively studied in the sense of bettering one's self, bettering one's environment, struggling to achieve ihsan in Arabic, which means perfection.
It seems that the religious establishment in Egypt does not speak with one voice, and some parts of it are perhaps more reform-friendly than others. And that suggests that things are much more complex than they seem to be. The president may give orders, but it is far from certain that heads will fly, as many believe.
Recently, in response to dramatic rise in divorce statistics, President Sisi called on Al-Azhar to reform the Islamic divorce procedure to make it harder for husbands to walk away. But he got a blunt nay from the clerics, and divorce is set to continue as a purely verbal renunciation of the wife by the husband.
You're listening to The Battle for Al-Azhar on Heart and Soul from the BBC World Service.
In order to understand the complex relationship between the religious establishment and the state, I put the question about the roots of the controversy surrounding Al-Azhar to Amr Izzat, a researcher on freedom of belief with the NGO, the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights. Mr. Izzat says the controversy about reform is as old as Islam's first encounter with modernity. Calls for reform are centuries old, a cliché, he says. The problem, says Izzat, is that both the state and Al-Azhar regard themselves as the guardians of the orthodoxy, They do not allow dissent, and when they try to challenge the likes of Daesh or Islamic State, they do so not as defenders of democratic values against extremism, but as a Muslim state backed up by Al-Azhar fighting a heretical sect. This goes back to a paradox in the way the modern Egyptian state defines itself. On the one hand, it is supposed to be a constitutional democracy, says Ezzat. Yet, at the same time, it has kept alive the idea of all Muslims as an ummah. And this, says Ezzat, is one of the main ideas underlying the ideology of all groups of political Islam, including Daesh. Jihad, according to this way of thinking, defines one of the crucial aspects of the Muslims' relationship to the others. Modern thinking was supposed to make a total break with this tradition. If such a break were to happen, adds Ezzat, the jihadi ideology will eventually lose meaning. Al-Azhar, says Ezzat, has never revised the jihad doctrine of Islam, and thus it stands firmly on the same ideological grounds as Daesh. Mr. Ezzat's view of the prospects of Al-Azhar carrying out the much-called-for reform is rather pessimistic. It is the least capable of leading that change, he adds. The belief that the world is divided between Muslims and the rest of the world, and that Muslims are all one nation or ummah set against the rest, is much more than a doctrine upheld by Al-Azhar and the Egyptian state. It is actually a popular idea, almost part of the Egyptian or Islamic culture. Every Friday, the Egyptian radio broadcasts songs like these. O God, bring back the lost glory of the Ummah and unify all Muslims under the banner of its immortal leaders, goes this song. This makes you wonder, who can challenge this deep-seated idea?
You have an institution that is...
This woman thinks she has the answer.
My name is Rabab Kamal. I'm a writer, and I write about secularism, liberalism in Egypt, blasphemy laws, renewal of religious discourse, and also about feminist issues, because one way or the other, they are all related in a country like Egypt, in the Middle East.
And what exactly do you hope to achieve by that?
What I hope to achieve is to, let's say, rock the boat. Because what we need is a real revolution. Revolution is not just about burning tires. A real revolution is a revolution of thought. We need to change our mindset.
Reality, you are a drop in the ocean in a predominantly conservative society.
You understand that you are a drop in the ocean, and all you are trying to do is to work with other drops in the ocean, just trying to make a small wave. This is how change becomes or happens. Not only am I critical of Al-Azhar, I'm also critical of the state, the system, because religion and politics are connected with each other. It's even from the time when Egypt was under a constitutional monarchy. In May 1952, there was a religious ruling, a fatwa, from Al-Azhar. And this religious ruling said that women are not allowed to either vote or run for parliament. So why did it change in 1956? A lot of people would say because President Nasser decided to give that right to women. Wrong answer. It changed because women in Egypt since 1923, since the time of Munira Sebit, who was a very famous feminist, and other feminists like Ameni Farid, Durraya Shafiq, they were working on that right. So my point of view is not only waiting for the renewal of religious discourse from inside Al-Azhar, it changes if we work on the liberal, humanist, and human rights. You keep on pushing for that. So this is the part that I'm working on. I'm working on start asking for your rights, for your basic rights, and the Al-Azhar, the state religious institution, has to, let's go with the flow, or they will just vanish.
Back at Al-Azhar Mosque, there is a Quran memorization class for women going on. The teacher says one verse and the women repeat after him, so on and so forth. And this reminds me of the primary role of Al-Azhar. It is here to preserve and protect the Islamic faith and tradition, literally committing it to every individual memory. An institution that sees itself as the proud guardian of tradition and orthodoxy, and a popular one at that, cannot overnight redefine itself to satisfy those clamoring for change. A few minutes away from Al-Azhar Mosque is what is known as Madinat Al-Ba'uth Al-Islamiyya, which is basically the hostels for foreign students at Al-Azhar. They're building new blocks to house more students in the future, which could only mean one thing. Al-Azhar is expanding its global reach. Of all Muslim-majority states in the world, it's actually Malaysian students who are the largest contingent of foreign students at Al-Azhar here in Egypt. But why is Al-Azhar such a magnet for the Malaysians? Next week, I will be heading to Malaysia to find out. The Battle for Al-Azhar was a whistle-down production for the BBC. It was written and presented by me, Magdi Abdelhadi. The producer was Ava Dadrian.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Need is a real revolution. Revolution is not just about burning tires. A real revolution is a revolution of thought. We need to change our mindset.
Reality, you are a drop in the ocean in a predominantly conservative society.
You understand that you are a drop in the ocean, and all you are trying to do is to work with other drops in the ocean, just trying to make a small wave. This is how change becomes or happens. Not only am I critical of Al-Azhar, I'm also critical of the state, the system, because religion and politics are connected with each other. It's even from the time when Egypt was under a constitutional monarchy. In May 1952, there was a religious ruling, a fatwa, from Al-Azhar, and this religious ruling said that women are not allowed to either vote or run for parliament. So why did it change in 1956? A lot of people would say because President Nasser decided to give that right to women. Wrong answer. It changed because women in Egypt since 1923, since the time of Munira Sebit, who was a very famous feminist, and other feminists like Ameni Farid, Durraya Shafiq, they were working on that right. So my point of view is not only waiting for the renewal of religious discourse from inside Al-Azhar, it changes if we work on the liberal, humanist, and human rights. You keep on pushing for that. So this is the part that I'm working on. I'm working on start asking for your rights, for your basic rights, and the Al-Azhar, the state religious institution, has to, let's go with the flow, or they will just vanish.
Back at Al-Azhar Mosque, there is a Quran memorization class for women going on. The teacher says one verse and the women repeat after him, so on and so forth. And this reminds me of the primary role of Al-Azhar. It is here to preserve and protect the Islamic faith and tradition, literally committing it to every individual memory. An institution that sees itself as the proud guardian of tradition and orthodoxy, and a popular one at that, cannot overnight redefine itself to satisfy those clamoring for change. A few minutes away from Al-Azhar Mosque is what is known as Madinat Al-Ba'uth Al-Islamiyya, which is basically the hostels for foreign students at Al-Azhar. They're building new blocks to house more students in the future, which could only mean one thing. Al-Azhar is expanding its global reach. Of all Muslim-majority states in the world, it's actually Malaysian students who are the largest contingent of foreign students at Al-Azhar here in Egypt. But why is Al-Azhar such a magnet for the Malaysians? Next week, I will be heading to Malaysia to find out. The Battle for Al-Azhar was a whistle-down production for the BBC. It was written and presented by me, Magdi Abdelhadi. The producer was Ava Dadrian.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.